Hi, this is Dwight Gingrich. Welcome back to Was Jesus Okay with Homosexuality? This is session 5 of 6. This session is called Historical Conclusions, Was Jesus Okay with Homosexuality? I originally shared this material as a blog post. The blog version of this session includes extra features, including 35 footnotes documenting my sources and adding extra comments. To access these features, visit www.dwightgingrich.com and search for the 6-part series, Was Jesus Okay with Homosexuality? Let's begin session 5. In this session, I want to summarize our findings about Jesus and homosexuality from our last 3 sessions, and then evaluate 3 possible counterarguments from the Gospels. Did Jesus say some people are born gay? Did he heal a centurion's male lover? And what about Jesus and the person John calls his beloved disciple? I'll finish answering the question, was Jesus okay with homosexual behavior, in this session, and then in my final session, I'll address the question, is Jesus okay with homosexual behavior now? In this series on homosexuality, I have focused on Jesus, discussing other biblical witnesses primarily in relation to him. There are at least 2 reasons for this focus on Jesus. First, I believe that being a Christian starts with following Jesus. It certainly does not end there, see my red letter reductionism essay, but it is never less. As John wrote, "Whoever says he abides in him, in Jesus, ought to walk in the same way in which he walked." 1 John 2, verse 6. If we can learn directly from Jesus how we ought to think and act regarding homosexuality, let us do so. And second, Jesus is often seen as the weak link in the Bible's stance against homosexual behavior. If the idea that Jesus approved of loving same-sex relationships turns out to be historically unbelievable, then this illusion of a weak link is removed, and the witness of all of Scripture is seen to be consistent. In discussing Jesus' views of homosexual behavior, I have also presented much of the other biblical evidence on the topic, but I have not directly addressed valuable questions like, must Christians obey the Leviticus laws against homosexual behavior? Nor have I attempted a detailed exegesis of Paul's teachings against homosexual activity. Rather, I have placed these biblical passages alongside other ancient texts and looked for consistent patterns, with one guiding question: what light do these passages shine on what Jesus himself believed? What then did we find? First, we examined Jesus' apparent silence on homosexuality. Jewish teachers in Jesus' day who mentioned homosexual behavior consistently condemned it, and it was nearly unknown among Jews at the time. It was something out there that non-Jews did, and no Jewish rabbi had to stake out his public position on the topic. If any rabbi had been suspected of disagreeing with this Jewish consensus, he would have been rapidly rejected by fishermen and Pharisee alike. Given this historical evidence, there was little reason for Jesus to specifically mention homosexual behavior, and every reason to assume he agreed with the Jewish consensus. Second, we asked if Jesus' emphasis on love is proof that he approved of loving homosexual relationships. Does love your neighbor mean Jesus affirmed gay love? Ancient Jews saw no contradiction between commanding neighbor love and condemning homosexual activity. Paul likewise paired these teachings in his letters to Rome and Corinth. Unlike our culture, the New Testament consistently contrasts love and sexual indulgence. In Jesus' view, love your neighbor is the second commandment, subordinate to the most important commandment, love the Lord your God. Thus, it is not truly loving to help your neighbor violate God's will. Given this ancient context, Jesus' emphasis on love is not proof that he approved of loving homosexual relationships. If anything, it is the opposite. And third, we considered three ways that Jesus' original Jewish audience would have understood him to be addressing the topic of homosexual behavior, despite never explicitly naming it. Jesus taught, "You shall not commit adultery," a command that was understood by ancient Jews to also prohibit, by implication, all other unlawful sexual behaviors. Jesus also taught against porneia, or sexual immorality, which was universally understood in Judaism to include same-sex intercourse. And Jesus warned against aselgia, or debauchery, a word that Jesus could easily turn to as a synonym for homosexual activity and other similarly shocking behavior forbidden by the Jewish law, a word used in 2 Peter 2, verse 7, to describe the filthy conduct of the people of Sodom and Gomorrah. What might Jesus' Jewish listeners say if they heard the claim that Jesus said nothing about homosexual activity? Of course he did. We clearly heard him mention adultery, porneia, and aselgia. But is there counter-evidence? Despite the evidence we've shared in this series, some still point to several events in Jesus' ministry as proof that Jesus affirmed homosexual behavior, as long as it was loving and consensual. In this session, I'd like to discuss three examples that are perhaps most often mentioned. It's my impression that relatively few scholars find the following argument significant, but some do, so I will address them. The first counterargument is a suggestion that Jesus said some people are born gay. This argument uses Jesus' words about eunuchs from Matthew 19, verse 12. Quote, "For there are eunuchs who have been so from birth, and there are eunuchs who have been made eunuchs by men, and there are eunuchs who have made themselves eunuchs for the sake of the kingdom of heaven. Let the one who is able to receive this receive it." Clearly, Jesus affirmed that some people are born as eunuchs. But what is a eunuch, or evnoukos? Here it is easy to get lost down a deep, dark hole exploring all the ways that the Greek word evnoukos was used. The first thing I want to say is that, yes, the word evnoukos, or eunuch, may sometimes have been used to refer to someone who experienced same-sex desires. Scholars do not all agree on this question. However, evnoukos was not a word that specifically referred to homosexuals, and most eunuchs were not homosexual. Perhaps the most respected dictionary of New Testament Greek is the Greek-English Lexicon of the New Testament and Other Early Christian Literature by Bauer, Danker, Arndt, and Gingrich, commonly known as BDAG. BDAG lists three uses of the word evnoukos, and it matches these three uses to Jesus' three uses in this passage. The first definition provided is a castrated male person, or eunuch, which it matches with Matthew 19, verse 12b. Second definition, a human male who, without a physical operation, is by nature incapable of begetting children, an impotent male. This is matched with Jesus' first use of the term in Matthew 19, verse 12. And the third definition, a human male who abstains from marriage without being impotent, a celibate, which is matched with the third use of Jesus' use of the term in Matthew 19, verse 12. Here we need to remember that, in any given circumstance, a word means what it means in that specific context, not necessarily what it sometimes means in other contexts. Linguists warn of a word study fallacy called illegitimate totality transfer. Craig Blomberg defines this term, and his definition is on point, especially the second half of his definition. Quote, "Assuming that a word carries several or all of its possible meanings in each of its appearances, when in fact the most probable meaning of any word is that which contributes the least amount of new information to the overall context. Assuming that a word carries several or all of its possible meanings in each of its appearances, when, in fact, the most probable meaning of any word is that which contributes the least amount of new information to the overall context," unquote. So what does the context indicate Jesus meant by evnoukos, or eunuch, in Matthew 19, verse 12? Well, Jesus actually uses the word in three different but related ways. That is, each occurrence of evnoukos has its own immediate context, from birth, or made by men, or made themselves, yet they all share the same larger context within Jesus' discussion. The immediate context for each use is relatively clear, but how does the larger context constrain and specify what Jesus means here in all three uses by evnoukos? In the larger context, Jesus is responding to a question of the Pharisees about divorce. Jesus responds by affirming the creation model of male-female marriage with its one-flesh sexual union, Matthew 19:3-9. Jesus' disciples, dismayed at the strict limitations Jesus places on divorce, suggest a second option, not to marry, Matthew 19:10. It's important to notice that Jesus' comments about eunuchs occur within his response to this second option, not to marry. Jesus and his disciples, as good Jews, do not imagine any third option. The two options are male-female marriage or not to marry. Eunuchs in Jesus' discussion fall into the latter category. No marriage, and therefore, in the Jewish worldview Jesus shared, no sexual union. Thus, despite the differences between the three categories of eunuchs Jesus describes, the common ground for all three that makes Jesus' illustration work is that they are people who are not engaging in sexual relationships. Other issues like sexual orientation or even reproduction are not the subject of conversation in this passage. Rather, Jesus is saying that some people fall into the not-to-marry category for three possible reasons. 1. They were born with conditions that leave them unsuited for marriage. 2. They were castrated. Or 3. They voluntarily give up marriage for the sake of the kingdom of heaven. So, did Jesus say that some people are born gay? Not really, although his words do indicate that not every male is born suited for marriage. More importantly, however, his words indicate that for everyone, whatever their sexual desires, there are only two options: faithful male-female marriage until death, or not to marry. Robert Gagnon's summary is on point. Quote, Jesus' comparison of men who make themselves eunuchs for the kingdom of heaven with born eunuchs shows that Jesus categorized born eunuchs as persons not having any sex. For certainly Jesus was not giving the disciples permission to have sex outside of marriage, and thereby to avoid his newly enunciated standard for marriage. So, from that standpoint, any argument that is made about born eunuchs, including homosexual persons, with which I would agree, leads to the view that Jesus did not give homosexually oriented persons the option of sex outside of marriage between a man and a woman. Unquote. Jesus' words about eunuchs are not a blessing on same-sex relationships, but they are a clear reminder to the church to honor those who, whatever their condition as eunuchs, are faithfully celibate for the sake of the kingdom of heaven. A second counter-argument is the suggestion that Jesus affirmed a gay couple, a centurion and his boy. This argument is based on Matthew 8, verses 5 to 13, or the parallel passage in Luke 7, verses 1 to 10. This argument is based primarily on one story, one historical fact, and two Greek words. The story is the account of Jesus healing a centurion's servant. The historical fact is that in ancient Greco-Roman culture, it was not uncommon for a master to have a servant who also functioned as his male lover. And the Greek words are pes and entimos. The term pes, found in Matthew's and Luke's accounts of this story, can mean boy and was sometimes used to refer to a male lover. And Luke's account describes a servant as being entimos in the eyes of the centurion, a word that can mean dear. Some who promote homosexual relationships among Christians go far beyond these facts. Jesuit priest John McNeil, for example, translates the centurion as talking about my beloved boy and proposes this interpretation. Quote, here we have the most direct encounter of Jesus with someone who would today be pronounced gay, and Jesus' reaction was acceptance of the person without judgment, and even eagerness to be of assistance to restore the pest to health, and by implication to restore the loving relationship of the two, making possible the renewal of any sexual activity which they would have enjoyed together prior to the illness. Unquote. There are multiple problems with this interpretation. First, pes usually carries no sexual connotations whatsoever. Only other contextual clues can provide this meaning. When used of human relationships in the New Testament and other early Christian literature, pes refers either to a boy, a son, or a servant or slave. There are no sexual connotations in any of the other places pes is used in the New Testament. In fact, later in Matthew, in a quote from Isaiah, Jesus is described as being God's beloved pes, my beloved servant. Clearly, a pes can even be described as beloved without there being any necessary sexual connotations, or else such language would not have been used by God about his own servant. Second, in neither Matthew nor Luke do we find the centurion talking about my beloved boy, as McNeil put it. What we have instead is the narrator Luke saying that the centurion's doulos, slave or servant, was entimos in the eyes of the centurion. Much has been made of how the similar terms pes and doulos are used in Matthew's and Luke's accounts, but no explanation is sure enough to strongly determine our interpretation of the passage. More clearly, entimos fails to support the case for homosexual relationship. Though entimos can be translated dear, the two main senses of the word in the New Testament are honored, respected, or valuable, precious. Dear, in fact, is related to the latter sense. It can imply an emotional attachment based on value, without the presence of sexual desire. Most English translations of this verse use a term such as highly valued. The servant was highly valued in his master's eyes. Similarly, Luke's only other use of entimos is usually translated as distinguished or honorable. See Luke 14, verse 8. Some argue that it is unreasonable to imagine a Roman centurion would plead for Jesus to heal a mere servant unless that servant were his lover. But are we willing to argue that sexual interest is the strongest possible motivation? If this centurion could possess a faith greater than Jesus had found in Israel, see Matthew 8, verse 10, why could he not also possess a great and non-sexual concern for a valued servant? If the centurion who called for Peter, in Acts 10, verses 2 and 7, was a devout man who feared God with all his household, and gave alms generously, and had a devout soldier among those who attended him, why could this believing centurion in Matthew and Luke not likewise sincerely care for those who attended him? Third, if we take into account Jesus' assessment of how valuable or entimos the servant was to the centurion, then we must also consider Luke's report of how valuable the centurion was to the Jews. Luke reports that the elders of the Jews pleaded earnestly with Jesus on behalf of the centurion, saying, he is worthy to have you do this for him, for he loves our nation, and he is the one who built us our synagogue. Luke 7, 4-5. If a deeply observant God-fearer or Gentile proselyte would not practice pederasty, surely a pious Jew would avoid supporting it. Perhaps the centurion was not a God-fearer, but only a benefactor. Nevertheless, can we really imagine Jews in Jesus' day offering such high praise for someone they know is practicing pederasty? Can we imagine them pleading with Jesus to heal a pederast's beloved boy? Can we imagine the Jewish crowd standing quietly by as Jesus took an active pederast and preached him into the kingdom? Matthew 8, verses 11 to 12. In contrast to such scenarios, commentator Joel Green's assessment of the centurion's possible motives is refreshingly reasonable. Quote, "His desire to see his slave return to health need not imply an extraordinary humanitarian concern on his part, since care for sick slaves was advised in Roman antiquity as a way to prolong their usefulness. At the same time, Luke's language suggests that the centurion not only regarded the slave as useful, but actually esteemed him. There is no socio-historical reason to doubt that, as an urban slave in the home of a wealthy master, this dying man might have enjoyed friendship with the centurion." Unquote. The hypothesis that Jesus affirmed a gay couple by healing the centurion's boy creates far more problems than it solves. Finally, let's look at a third counter-argument. This counter-argument suggests that Jesus had a homosexual relationship with his beloved disciple. The disciple whom Jesus loved is first mentioned in John's account of the Last Supper. There we read that one of his disciples whom Jesus loved was reclining at table at Jesus' side, John 13:23. A more word-for-word translation could read, "reclining on the chest of Jesus." But the position of the beloved disciple is not to be understood as resting on top of Jesus. We know that this disciple was very close to Jesus, yet not actually on top of him, because later, when he wanted to ask Jesus a question, John 13, verse 25, the easiest way for him to address Jesus was to lean back until his head literally rested on Jesus' chest. This physical proximity may make us uncomfortable. Scholars, however, point to abundant evidence that such practices were normal and non-sexual in Jesus' day. For special meals like the Passover, people reclined next to each other on couches to eat. If this Last Supper meal followed standard banquet procedure, three people were reclining at the head table, including Jesus and his beloved disciple, leaning on his left elbow just to Jesus' right. The parable of the rich man and Lazarus similarly describes Lazarus lying on the chest of Abraham, Luke 16, verse 23. As one commentator says, "One might also lay one's head on another's bosom, which in that culture, far more tactile than our own, had no necessary sexual connotations." Commentator Klink reminds us of our own cultural biases. Quote, "The Western reader must be immediately reminded that such physical closeness was, and is, quite different in an Eastern context. In many parts of the world today, men walk down the street holding hands as a sign of friendship, not as a sign of homosexuality. This is an especially common practice between two men operating together in a business relationship, reflecting mutual respect and trust. With this in view, the actions of the beloved disciple become wordless communication that shows mutual trust and respect." Unquote. Some point to an event during Jesus' crucifixion as more evidence that Jesus had an erotic relationship with the disciple whom he loved. In John 19, verses 26 to 27, we read, "When Jesus saw his mother and the disciple whom he loved standing nearby, he said to his mother, 'Woman, behold your son.' Then he said to the disciple, 'Behold your mother.' And from that hour, the disciple took her to his own home." Commentator Keener, however, points to multiple ancient Greek texts in which people either promise to take a friend's mother as their own if the friend dies, or entrust their own mother to the care of a friend. He also points to texts which described a disciple's virtue in terms of caring for the teacher's family. In this case, there was an additional motivation for Jesus' choice. This from Keener, quote, "Most important, because Jesus' brothers did not believe, Jesus entrusted his believing mother to a disciple. This model suggests that the ties of the believing community must be stronger than natural familial bonds, a moral amply illustrated by the Jesus tradition. Unquote. How then do we explain this disciple's special title as the one Jesus loved? First, the beloved disciple was probably the Apostle John, who was indeed part of the inner circle of the three disciples closest to Jesus. Second, he was probably also the author of the Gospel, and may have used this term as a form of authorial modesty and gratitude for receiving Jesus' love. And third, his anonymity invites the reader to interact with him not just as a historical figure, but as an ideal disciple to be imitated. Whatever the reasons for this title, we should note that John also records Jesus as having special love for Lazarus, he whom you love, in John 11, verse 3 and 36, and for his sisters Mary and Martha. Further, the verbs agapao and phileo and their cognates, which are the words used for love in all these passages, nowhere in John's Gospel have a sexual connotation. As Keener writes, given John's Jewish context, any implied sexual relationship between Jesus and the beloved disciple would be impossible without the Gospel somewhere indicating a lifting of Jewish sexual taboos. Unquote. If John's readers would have protested at the idea of Jesus having a homosexual relationship with his beloved disciple, so would have Jesus' other disciples. The problem with all homosexual interpretations of Jesus and the beloved disciple is clearly revealed in a statement made by the Anglican priest Paul Oestreicher. Oestreicher claims that Jesus did have a homosexual relationship with his beloved disciple, and he says that the evidence would be so interpreted in any person today. But Jesus didn't live today, and not in Oestreicher's Western culture either. When we read these texts within the historical context of Jesus' own ancient Jewish culture, it becomes clear that no one then saw any reason to come to any such homosexual interpretation of Jesus' actions. Why should we imagine we can understand their culture better than they did? So, was Jesus okay with homosexual activity? I've discussed the big picture arguments regarding Jesus' silence about homosexuality and his ethic of love. And in this session, I've also evaluated three details from Jesus' life and ministry that have sometimes been used to paint a pro-homosexual Jesus. More importantly, we have examined all this evidence within the larger historical context of Jesus' own time and place. I believe the evidence points clearly in one direction. The total available historical evidence fits only with the hypothesis that Jesus, the historical Jesus of Nazareth, did not approve of homosexual behavior. This fact is not surprising, for it appears that Jesus built his sexual ethic on the Genesis 1 and 2 creation account, as is seen in Matthew 19, verses 3 to 8. The structure of Jesus' argument in this passage, and he's drawing on God himself, is that it is because God made humans male and female that they become one flesh in marriage. Jesus used this creation reality to forbid the separation of male-female one-flesh unions, but it is equally relevant to the question of homosexual unions, for the very basis given in the creation account for becoming one flesh is the same yet different duality of male and female. According to Genesis, Eve was taken from Adam and made to be a helper who was corresponding to him. Genesis 2 verse 20. Another male would not help Adam, nor was Eve designed to correspond to another female. Thus, male-to-male and female-to-female unions have no foundation in God's creation design, but actually contradict it. The fact that Jesus drew on this from the beginning creation design as the foundation for his answer to divorce strongly indicates he would have done the same in his answer to homosexual behavior, just in fact as other Jews in his day actually did. Conclusion. At this point, some listeners will be more than content believing that it is clear what Christians today should believe about the ethics of homosexual behavior. Other listeners, perhaps agreeing with much of my historical analysis, will nevertheless feel the question of Christian belief and practice today is still open. For the latter listeners, I have one more session addressing this question: is it okay for Christians today to affirm homosexual behavior? For now, however, we should pause to reaffirm what we already know. While individual pieces of evidence can be used to paint a pro-homosexual Jesus, the total available historical evidence fits only with the hypothesis that Jesus did not approve of homosexual behavior. Thank you for listening to Session 5 of Was Jesus Okay with Homosexuality? There's one more session in this series, Session 6, called Conclusions for Today, Is Jesus Okay with Homosexuality Now? I invite you to continue listening or to visit www.dwightgingrich.com to leave a comment or review what you just heard. This material is copyright 2019 by Dwight Gingrich, but you have my permission to share it if you do so freely and give proper credit. Thanks again for listening, and God bless your day.